Dave Max, Cork History Matters, brought to you by Red FM.
Gabriel Doherty of UCC, thank you for joining me for this Cork History Matters podcast, an ongoing series of conversations you've been kind enough to offer me. The inside of your brain and all of the research and the work and the studies and the reading that you've done over the years. Actually, you know what? Maybe at the outset of this, I don't know if I've inquired off you. Where did your interest in history grow from?
The very first book, Irish book on Irish history, that I ever read were the two. The first was Dorothy McArdle's Landmark Study of the Irish Republic, published in 1937-38. In effect, the Fianna Fáil Bible of Irish history. And the second was a very favourable biography of De Valera, written in the 1950s. So in terms of my initial exposure to this period, it was very much on, as it were, the pro-Dev side of things. And I've always wondered to myself whether I've ever fully divested myself of those initial prejudices.
Well, my namesake, Dorothy McArdle, I've read and heard of her, but I think you're the first I've heard reference her outright like that. And
it is one of the landmark studies, even to the present day. I mean, I would still constantly use it as reference.
Magic. Yeah. And that was the spark point for you?
Yeah. And I've even now when I read both of those books, thankfully, they're two very, very good books. I mean, the biography, even though it was, to a certain extent, a soft soap biography of De Valera, it was an exceptionally well written biography.
And at what age did you come across that? Because I was expecting more like, oh, when I was eight, my dad gave me the geography, an atlas of Europe, and I read about Hitler's.
I was about 7 or 8. That's when I first read it.
Unusual book? I mean, I know you are now a history professor, so perhaps it's not.
Well, the McArdle book was missing the cover, so I covered it with the then cornflakes packet. So it has a historical interest because as the cornflakes packet, as it stood in the 1970s, and it still has that cornflakes packet cover.
But as a boy of that age, you know, was it because your dad had it? You know, what drew you to that? What made you look at that and think that's a book I want to read, or was that the sort of level of literature you were reading at the time anyway?
Well, I'm not, to be honest, I can't quite remember. It wasn't that I was pushed into it by my parents, although there were some history books around, but Dad was a bus driver and Mum worked from home, so there wasn't much money to buy lots of books. But and you didn't really need it because that type of book, certainly the McArdle book, is so thick and dense. You didn't really need to read a huge amount more at that stage to have your interest ignited. And they're both superbly written, very, very detailed, and it just fired my imagination. Mm.
I've
never really lost that sense of wonder and awe at what went on 100 years ago.
And so it was even specific. So the matters that we're talking about are the ones that drew you into history, full stop.
The very things that got me first interested in history as a general subject. Obviously, yeah. I've studied many other things, many other periods, many other countries, but I always come back to this period in Irish history.
Well, you know, so you've sort of admitted to your Dev stripes. But you know, is that the duality of Irish history? Is it fair that sort of sense of a one side and the other? I mean, I suppose it still pertains to some degree, or doesn't it?
Unfortunately, because of the party political developments, some elements of that was almost inevitable, and benefited certain constituencies of opinion, both on the pro and anti-treaty side. Thankfully, most people were able to discern the truth of the matter, that the truth wasn't as black and white, and it wasn't all virtue, wasn't all on one side or on the other of that divide over the treaty.
Well, would you paint it maybe for us in simple terms before we delve into it a little bit more deeply? I mean, Dev spent a lot of time towards the end of the War of Independence in the United States, and maybe, you know, not necessarily his detractors, but those on perhaps the other side of the fence might say, oh, that was a deliberate, cunning move on his behalf to remove himself from the seat of the theatre to leave the others in it so that he could return and blah, blah, blah. But those sorts of stories did emerge. Where's Dev? Where's Collins? Yeah. Everyone's tired. It's come to a stalemate. There's treaty talks, as there had been at the Christmas previous. Where are we with all of that? And we'll get into Dev and Collins then as we get on.
In the summer of 1921... certainly, it wasn't a military stalemate in the sense that the British certainly believed that they were getting the upper hand. And in one sense, they were. I mean, their policy, for example, of internment, simply arresting and interning large numbers of males, regardless of whether they were particularly active or not, had the effect of both removing many activists from the scene and, I suppose, generally deterring others from becoming active. But it hadn't completely destroyed, by any manner of means, the IRA capacity to carry out a sustained campaign. What you did have in the spring and summer of 1921 was a diversion away from the centres, such as Cork and Tipperary and Limerick. You started to have parts of Leinster and Connacht engaging British forces. Some of this was deliberate policy to try and ease the pressure on the active areas, particularly which were under martial law at this point. And some of it simply just took that long to get some of these areas up to speed. So the IRA certainly was by no means a beaten docket. And the British Army, I suppose, almost inevitably perceived that it was winning the war, as all armies tend to do. The British realised that if they didn't win the war quickly and they faced into an autumn and another winter, then they were in trouble, because there was a briefing provided by General Macready that said, we'll have to replace the entire army. Basically, every single officer and every single soldier are so demoralised by the conditions of service that we'll have to move them all out and have to bring in an enormous number of new troops, taking them from the Empire and training it in Britain, etc. And inevitably, this was going to handicap the British effort for a while until they got up to speed. So the British were very keen, certainly Macready, to have an all-out effort in the summer months of 1921. But an all-out effort came at too high a price as far as the cabinet were concerned. So that's one part of the story. The second part of the story is the fact that the Government of Ireland Act is now being implemented, that Northern Ireland has been created. The King visits the Parliament of Northern Ireland, the new Parliament in Belfast, City Hall, as it was then, it ultimately moved to Stormont. So the British have a card in the hole. I mean, they have the border in place. They have Northern Ireland. And Lloyd George, I think, realises that this offers sort of a card that he can play in the negotiations. And on the Republican side, there's also a realisation, I think, that the British aren't going to be beaten out simply by force of arms. But some of the, as were the back channel, suggest that the British may be amenable to some form of negotiated settlement whereby the Republicans could get what they wanted, while at the same time offering enough to the British that would satisfy British demand, such as concessions on defence and things like that, which the British were, of course, concerned about after the First World War, and the Republicans didn't regard as absolutely central. So there seemed to be enough room for manoeuvre in the middle ground, with both sides, in effect, coming towards the conclusion that George Orr was better than War War.
In a way, I mean, well, I'm not sure if you can say the same for the British, but the Irish Republicans were not going to get what they wanted.
No.
Did they know that? And to what, you know?
Well, this is where De Valera is clever. I mean, De Valera says that what we're aiming for is a republic, in effect, where we are in control of our own matters, and in effect, sovereignty comes from the people. What the British were concerned with was things like defence and loyalty and membership of the empire. So what De Valera does is devise this formula, which many people have mocked, but which was used by the Indians, for example, in the aftermath of the Second World War when India became independent, the concept of external association, whereby there would be an association between Ireland and the Commonwealth. Ireland would be attached to the Commonwealth, as it were, externally, rather than being a member of it and as it were, internally. But that the Irish would then recognise the King not as the source of sovereignty in Ireland, which would come from the people as a republic, but they would recognise the King as the symbol of that association. But the King would have no more role in Ireland, in the same way that Ireland nowadays would recognise the head of the United Nations as head of the association of which Ireland is a member. Mm. But the King would have rather less power in that role than the modern head of the United Nations has in that sense. It would simply be a symbol recognising Ireland's association with the Commonwealth rather than anything more substantial than that. And it was a clever formula. Certainly in terms of the negotiations, before the negotiations, the talks by talks, the telegrams are exchanged between De Valera and Lloyd George over the autumn of 1921 before the London talks began.
Because when are we talking truce?
Truce is in, I just have to remember, is in July, I think it is. I'd have to just check the exact date. And then you have Well, even a truce is interesting because to negotiate a truce and to publicly agree a truce... You have to accept that the other side is an army. That you, in effect, it involved the tacit recognition by the British forces, by the British army.
Which they'd refused to do.
Absolutely, and they'd consistently depicted Republicans as a murder gang, a criminal conspiracy, and you don't conclude...
They had murder by the throat.
Exactly.
But it turns out now it was an army they were fighting.
Exactly. Now, internally, many memoranda from the British army over the previous year had recognised the military capability of the IRA, but it had been found politic, as it were, for the cabinet to constantly use this rhetoric of the murder gang. But if you don't negotiate a truce with a murder gang, you do concede a truce with the IRA. And the British army, especially MacCready, recognised what this meant. It meant that if war broke out again, you couldn't do what the British had done. You couldn't intern people. You couldn't execute them. In effect, it tacitly accepted that the executions had been illegal because you're executing prisoners of war, members of an army. So it had enormous number of ramifications, very serious ones, for how the previous war had been conducted and possibly also how the next war, if it ever broke out again, would have to be conducted.
So you'd have to presume that their agreeing to a truce in the first place was itself a momentous decision.
Absolutely. And it happens almost overnight. I mean, on the Friday, the British are still talking the talk of the murder gang and murder by the throat and we'll beat them. And on the following Monday, they're recognising De Valera as the head of a substantial majority of the Irish opinion, inviting him over to London for talk.
It is quite a turnaround.
Well, the British are masters at when it suits, turning on a sixpence. And Lloyd George especially was known for being rather unscrupulous in such matters and conveniently forgetting all the previous rhetoric. And now seeming to recognise De Valera, not so much as head of the Dáil. The British never recognised Dáil Éireann because, of course, that was a step too far. But they did recognise that the election results of 1918 and the new elections in 1921...
That there was a mandate there.
Yes. And recognised De Valera's role as head of that body of opinion. What they also did, however, was to recognise James Craig as head of Northern Ireland.
That's it. You know, this whole, you know, because in a way you can sort of look at the War of Independence and it seems relatively clean as to what was happening, even though, you know, you look a little under the cover and it's as complex as the rest of it. But certainly when you get into the truce and the treaty and the civil war, and it's just so, there's so many threads. Because, you know, even in this, what I'm tempted to ask is, at what point was there a realisation of partition? Obviously long before this. You know, the Republicans are fighting for an indivisible Irish Republic, which they're unlikely to ever get. So presumably the guys at the top know that the men who are out in the trenches are fighting for something that really is not deliverable at that point. Do the men know that?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that the strategy, certainly for Michael Collins, if you have a look at what he does, I think his general premise, if you get the British out militarily, if you get the British army to withdraw its forces from Ireland, which of course was one of the big selling points of the treaty, then in effect, everything else would follow. That the British power and influence in Ireland was based on its military strength. And if you remove that military strength, then issues such as the border and the unionists would, as it were, you could deal with them
internally
and based on their strength and without the backing of having the entire British state at their back. So there was some sense certainly in Collins's approach to the treaty negotiations. I mean, that's one of the big things that he's determined to achieve. And of course, it is one of the things that achieved. And it's one of the things when we're talking about the descent into civil war is one of the things that Collins wants to avoid at all costs is to stop the withdrawal process. And the British have been pulling out in the early months of 1922 after the treaty is signed. They withdraw their troops from Victoria Barracks in Cork, from all the other barracks, and they concentrate them in Dublin prior to departure from Dublin. And then you have the series of events in the summer of 1922, the seizure of the forecourts, the assassination of Henry Wilson in London, etc. And The British threatened to stop the pullout, and it's only at that point that Collins makes the decision, which he desperately tried to avoid, which is to finally break with the anti-treaty Republicans. Up until that point, for all the bad blood that had been generated by the treaty vote and the treaty debate. He tried to maintain a line of contact with them. But it's only when he realises that ultimately, in the summer of 1922, it's either them or the British stop the pullout. And he makes the decision ultimately that he has to get the British out. And if that means fighting his erstwhile comrades, then that was a very high price, but it was one he was forced to pay.
That's why I was emphasising that sense of, you know, that's not what we were fighting for, because that seems to have been sort of the core of the anti-treaty thing.
Well, I mean, for the pro-treaty, in effect, what they were saying is that if we genuinely want to develop Ireland, if we genuinely want to realise our full potential, we have to cut our ties with Britain. And the only way that you can do it is to get the Brits out, as well, to get the troops out, to remove its entire military infrastructure. And if you do that...
Which is a huge achievement.
Which is, and in effect, what remains of British influence would wither on the vine. Remember that one of the other principal pillars of British influence in Ireland, which had been the landlord class, was already on the way out because of their estates had been bought out by the tenants, and that process hadn't yet completed, but it was well on the way to being so. The various different pillars of British influence, the landlords, particularly in rural areas, the British military, as far as Collins was concerned, you had to get rid of those before you could then start building from the floor up. Now, of course, the Republicans in their own time, in their own way, also had logic, logic to their position, which is that the only way that you've been able to galvanise the various different sections of Irish nationalism had been in the name of the Republic. All the various different other forms, whether it was home rule, dominion home rule, dual monarchy, the original Sinn Féin platform, all of these had failed to deliver the unity that the demand for the Republic had generated really after 1916 and through the War of Independence. So their argument was that if you pay the price of forsaking the Republic, what you would get would be a fractured, fragmented public opinion. And that in itself, it would be very difficult to build the island of which they dreamed, as it were. So there was logic on both sides. I mean, and of course, the problem is that you're facing a very powerful enemy. Mm. The additional problem then also is partition. Mm. And precisely because the British cleverly have introduced the border, the British, and this is a point I think that's very frequently asked, were willing to put pressure on the unionists to get rid of the border if they could get an agreement with the Republicans to stay within the empire. Precisely because the British were very keen to protect the southern unionists. And they recognised that a permanently partitioned Ireland would, one of the big losers would be southern unionists. Obviously, one of the other big losers would be northern nationalists, but the British weren't particularly concerned about those. So the British, and again, this is often forgotten, did put pressure on the unionists after the treaty is signed to voluntarily do away with the border. And they make this clear in the treaty debate at Westminster, because in addition to the treaty debates in Dáil Éireann, the treaty debates at Westminster, Lloyd George and others said, we want a united Ireland. We want a united Ireland in the empire. We have now achieved the position where we've got an agreement on the part of those who had stood for a republic to enter the empire, to recognise the king. And having done that, we think that the conditions have been achieved which would warrant doing away with the border. They do allow the unionists in the north to make the decision, and ultimately the unionists in the north say, no way, we're keeping the border. But that was the moment at which the border was at its most vulnerable.
So the northern unionists could have made a decision then that could have seen Ireland...
Yes, absolutely.
Undivided, yeah, and still within the empire.
Yes.
So they kind of cut off their nose to spite their face.
Well,
what
they did, one of the provisions of the treaty was to say the Parliament of Northern Ireland would vote either to remain within the Irish Free State. And this is a technical point. The treaty technically provided for a united Ireland, a 32-county dominion, the Irish Free State. But Northern Ireland would have the right to vote itself out. But if it did, then a boundary commission would be established to redraw the border. And the fear was on the part of many unionists was that that boundary commission would get rid of Fermanagh, Tyrone, South Armagh, West Derry, etc. And what would remain would be so small that it would be...
Non-viable.
And they would be forced in probably on less generous terms than they might otherwise have achieved. The British government recognised that the Southern Unionists on their own, as powerful as they were, as they had been during the Union, had been weakened by the Land Acts, by the fact that the landed class was now on the way out, and needed the augmentation of strength that the Northern Unionists could bring. And that in the long term, if that border lasted, then the Southern Unionist community would be effectively eclipsed, which is exactly, of course, what happened. So it is a point that is very frequently forgotten, that the British did expressed to the unionists the view that from London, and this includes people like Birkenhead, who had been on the unionist side during the Third Home Rule crisis, people like Andrew Bonar Law, the leader of the Conservative Party, as well as liberals such as Lloyd George, that the interests of Britain, the interests of Ireland, and the interests of unionism would be best served by doing away with the border.
Goodness me, it's really hard to actually navigate through all
it
of
is,
that.
It is. I mean, the general consensus is that the British, having established the border, sort of were determined to maintain it come what may, were the unionists were their instruments of power. But it's at this point that if you could have got, and the British thought they had got, the Southern Nationalists of whatever ilk to sign up to the Empire, the British, I think, frankly, were only too glad to see Ireland go its own way, so long as it remained within the Empire, because it had been such a disruptive force within the Union during the period after 1801.
So it would have been out of the Union, but within the Empire.
Yes.
Some also would say that the Free State, as it became, would have had less potential to turn into the sort of, like, you know, the Unionists used to say, Home Rule is Rome Rule.
Yep.
And in many respects, by abandoning the South and dividing the country, they almost, you know, helped that come to pass.
Well, of course. I mean,
there would have been a sizable minority within a united Ireland or a single island that couldn't have resisted that to the benefit of the whole country.
Well, and of course, remember that Northern Ireland then becomes a state which is absolutely dominated by the Protestant interest. Ultimately, what partition does is to create two entities which completely disrupts the religious balance as a whole. I think it's important to remember that Protestants didn't do too badly in the South. I mean, the Southern Protestant class certainly retained its very influential position in things like the law, medicine, in business, the Guinnesses and the like. So they weren't completely eclipsed, but certainly in terms of the general ethos of the Southern state, of course, it becomes Catholic and Gaelic in the same way that the North becomes very Protestant and British. What might have been the result had partition not taken place? Certainly you would have had the augmentation of the Southern Unionists with this very strong Northern Unionist bloc. And of course, you also wouldn't have had the problem that, of course, developed after 1920 of having the Northern Nationalists in effect being treated as outcasts within the six counties. Whether you would have had fresh problems, you probably would. I think the Unionists would have remained sort of a block apart. But again, in much the same way as the Southern Unionists were forced to make their peace with the reality of the new state and did reasonably well in terms of defending their interests after 1921, had the Northern Unionists voted themselves not so much into the Free State, but hadn't voted themselves out, I mean, they're a pretty hard-headed bunch, and I think they would have done a pretty good job of negotiating a way of defending their interests. And of course, you still would have had a residual British influence. I mean, you'd still have had things like the Navy was still, you're going to be using Cove and Castle Tambere as part of the treaty. And a number of other elements were written into the legislation to protect interests such as the issues such as divorce and so on and so forth. The 1920 Act, which would have presumably been some sort of a model for the subsequent legislation. So it's theoretical what might have happened, but what is not theoretical is that it could have happened. The coalition in London, having negotiated and signed the treaty, genuinely wanted the unionists in the North to vote themselves to remain in the Free State. But they couldn't do very much about it. I mean, having given the guarantee and used all the influence they had.
There's no real back channels between the Republicans in the South and the North. There's no real conversation exactly that way, is there? Is there conversation North-South or is it East-West?
I mean, it's not so much back channels. I mean, Michael Collins and James Craig have meetings in January 1922. And they started talking about various different matters, in particular that Collins agrees to try and to stop the Belfast boycott, where Republicans accompanying partition had done everything they possibly can to economically to weaken the new state, including things like putting boycott on accounts from banks and refusing to buy produce and so on and so forth. So Collins agrees to undo that, which in effect, of course, was recognising partition, as it were. James Craig agrees to try and ensure that Catholics who'd been thrown out of the shipyards in the summer of 1921 would be reinstated in their jobs.
And it's summer 22 that the Civil War breaks out, because I know that anti-treaty forces, you know, go north. This
is one of Collins's, as we're trying to keep many balls in the air. I mean, having signed a treaty, he then does his best to try and keep his options open. He keeps his options open with the British government, but the British government are increasingly wary and intolerant of what they see as his backsliding and his willingness to keep open the line of communication with the anti-treaty element of Sinn Féin. He has a line of communication with James Craig, which you just mentioned, where he meets. And this is the next time the two leaders of the two jurisdictions meet are the Terence O'Neill and Lammas meetings in the 60s, 40 years later. He keeps a line of communication open with the anti-treaty Republicans, particularly a joint campaign against Northern Ireland in the early months of 1922, as we're focusing on the common enemy. And it also has the useful added benefit of keeping the anti-treaty IRA away from the South. While Collins is building up, for example, the what was to become the National Army, he's also agreeing the new constitution, recruiting the Gardaí and the civil service. But what Collins also has to do is to make sure he keeps on side with many of the pro-treaty elements, because there were many pro-treaty elements. While they looked up to Michael Collins, some of them were not keen themselves on Collins maintaining this link with the anti-treaty Republicans. So both on the British side, James Craig was hearing, without any concrete proof, that Collins was collaborating and was the mastermind behind this campaign. And even the pro-treaty side were looking to Collins to try and make the final break with the anti-treaty Republicans. But that Collins was loath to do until he's forced to do so by the fact that the British ultimately say, if you don't, we'll stop the military pullout and we'll get rid of the Four Courts problem ourselves.
And the Four Courts problem was an occupation by anti-treaty agitators who were there to be a physical presence to say, we don't want this happening.
I mean, it was.
But were they there for long?
Yes, I mean, they were there for several months. I mean, it was rather strange because having occupied the Four Courts, they were then free to go in and out. They'd be going to the shops, buying the newspapers, and a rather sort of desultory presence. But they were an occupation, they had centres, and certainly it didn't make any sense to attack them, given that they didn't seem to be much of a threat. And in effect, they make a worse mistake than had been made in 1916, where at least in 1916, when they occupy buildings, they're militarily entrenching them and they're ready for a fight. Whereas with the Four Courts, it's sort of they occupy the building merely as a symbolic gesture and make themselves, of course, sitting ducks. When ultimately the decision is taken by Collins to attack them with artillery lent by the British.
Sitting ducks, but also, you know, hostages to fortune. I don't know if that phrase stands up, but you know, like they're inviting the
I'm not sure they invited the attack. I'm not sure whether they ever expected to be attacked.
Right.
But when they were attacked,
but if we are, we know what that means.
Yes, and they were very keen to play up what they saw as the parallel with 1916, with, as it were, the pro-treaty forces in effect this time being the equivalent of the British, and the anti-treaty forces equivalent of Pearce and others in the garrison in GPO.
So roughly we've the truce in the summer of 21. There's 6 to 12 months of working out.
Well, you have sort of about 3 months when they're talks, various different feelers. Mm. De Valera goes over with a delegation to London, a preliminary delegation, comes back, in effect saying what the British are offering we can't sign up to, but there's enough of a deal that we can keep open that communication. De Valera and Lloyd George have a series of telegrams passing between themselves over the autumn of 1921, trying to both of them negotiate into a position where you can start the talks. You don't have to go back to war, but you do so on the basis that's favourable to yourself. In October, then, the face-to-face negotiations begin in London. They conclude with the signing of the treaty on the 6th of December.
And where are you with the whole, like, De Valera? You know, why doesn't Dev go? Well, I mean, he is the main guy.
He is, and it was consistently that made the point, even before the delegation leaves, as well as...
Does he know that it's a poison chalice?
No, well, no. I mean, in one sense... He knows that the British aren't going to simply concede a republic in the traditional form of having no contact with Britain whatsoever. He genuinely believes that that the idea of external association is viable. It's one of that reasons that he maintains very close contact with the treaty delegation to make sure that they're not doing anything which would undermine that. Remember, De Valera also, in addition to the credentials presented by the Doyle, which in effect saying that the plenipotentiaries have the right to negotiate and conclude a treaty, De Valera also gave them secret instructions, which is to say, you don't sign anything until you refer that text back to Dublin and got agreement. So from that point of view, it certainly wasn't a question that De Valera was setting up the delegates for a fall, because if they had followed those instructions,
yes,
they would not have signed anything. De Valera wouldn't also have signed.
But you mentioned about how when it comes to civil war time or the four courts issue and the occupation in there of anti-treaty forces or anti-treaty agitators, military, the IRA, the anti-treaty IRA, and the British threat to say we'll stop the withdrawal and we'll go and take care of them, which obviously would have completely undermined any kind of sort of authority that the new Irish state was supposed to have and intending to display. But on the night of the negotiations was a similar threat by Lloyd George,
absolutely,
wasn't it? I mean, sign it or tomorrow we're back at war.
Well, I mean,
so what were they to do?
Well, I mean,
did they make a mistake in signing?
Well, I mean, you have to understand the enormous pressure they were under, psychologically speaking. And Lloyd George was...
But even what you're saying, like, don't sign anything until you've had approval.
Yes, and the delegates had gone back to Dublin the previous weekend. And De Valera had... And the text that they'd presented then was close to the final text of the treaty, albeit there were certain changes made at the last minute. And Collins ultimately says those changes were enough to warrant my signing. I mean, in effect, he makes the argument that wherever the private instructions, he said that this is the best we're going to get. We can't negotiate anything better. So ultimately, I'm going to sign it, not because I thereby guarantee the creation of a free state, but we refer the matter back to the Irish people. In effect, we sign and we...
And then see what people think.
See what people think.
Well, that seems fair enough.
Well, and it was a reasonable point. But what De Valera was saying, well, if you didn't stand for the Republic, in effect, you would never have been elected to the Dáil in the first place, and you wouldn't have then been in a position to be a plenipotentiary. So
what maybe then would Dev have preferred to have happened if
it's impossible
to know.
It's
probably a crude way to phrase
it. And ultimately, the British weren't going to continue to negotiate indefinitely at some point in time. And clearly, the 6th of December was the point at which they said, that's it, it's this or war. De Valera genuinely said, well, if that's the case,
we call their bluff.
Well, go to war. Go to war. In effect, he said that
back to war.
If that is what the British felt, they
just didn't have the capacity to do that.
Well, what Collins, it's not so much that. It's that Collins said, well, even if we do go back to war, the best that we can hope for
is still something like this.
Exactly. I mean, in effect, we're not going to beat them.
And yet more people will die, more misery.
And we could be in a far worse position. That we've got them to this position. This is the best we're going to get in terms of the military situation. It's not going to get any better. So this is what these are the key decisions, and we have to make the call now.
So, it's not even the truth, because it's not about the truth. It's not that there's one thing that's correct and
one that isn't.
But then what do you do? So Dev's like, go back to war. This is the best we'll get. If we go back to war, that's still the best we get, and we could actually be in a worse position. Who makes that call?
Well, ultimately, it's the Dáil. I mean, and Collins argues...
And they did make the call with
the vote. They did, because of the treaty vote, the debate in...
So should Dev have... Because, like, you know, Dev is the leader of the anti-treaty side of things, so... Yep. you know, was he being disingenuous accepting the Dáil vote?
Well, in effect, he says the Dáil has been asked to vote itself out of existence, which it did. I mean, ultimately, the Dáil
was a Republican Dáil.
The Dáil from 1919 through to 1922, I suppose, is a Republican Dáil. But the new Dáil that comes into existence in the autumn of 1922, after the Civil War breaks out, is a partitioned one. I mean, it only affects the 26 counties. It has to, its members have to swear the oath of allegiance, etc. So it's a very, very, to the king,
it's a very different,
it's a very
beast.
Different entity than the one that had preceded it. So De Valera, in effect, is saying that what is being proposed is ultra vires. It's beyond the power of the Dáil to vote itself out of existence, because ultimately, as a Republican body, it's only the people who could vote itself out of existence.
But are they starting to twist themselves almost into semantic knots?
Well, this is where De Valera, in effect, says there's a triple lock. He says that no deputy can vote for the treaty because every single TD has been elected on a Republican ticket, and therefore you would be violating your commitment to your constituents by doing that. He says the Dáil can't vote itself out of existence because, in effect, as a Republican body, it has been created by the Irish people, and only the Irish people can vote itself out of existence. And it's the kicker at the end. He said even the Irish people in the current circumstances can't do that because they're war-weary, and, in effect, the vote...
They're not in the right state of mind to make this decision. Then who does?
Well, I mean, and that's where the problem arises. In effect, the thesis being put forward by De Valera was that the circumstances, particularly this threat of renewed war, terrible war, in effect, that no contract made under duress is moral, is binding.
And that sounds reasonable, but I guess it's still...
In terms of practical politics...
Well, but still then you're left with, well, then what to do? Do we all just go off to the Canaries for a few months and come back and go, where are we, lads?
And that was one of the principal arguments put forward by the pro-treaty side, is that you at some point in time, we are going to have to make this decision, that for all the flaws in the procedure that has led to us arriving at this point, then ultimately... Even if the circumstances were ideal, we would still have to make this decision at some point in time. So better to make it now.
And it is funny because I think almost any Irish person who has an interest in Irish history on this matter and on this subject, you know, kind of believes in both calls.
Yeah, well, and that's the real irony of the situation, is that there is virtue on both sides, and to a certain extent there's vice on both sides.
Yeah,
there are flaws.
There is no right answer.
No, there isn't.
But is it not better then to just have done something and move forward with that, as opposed to no, we won't go? Or like, well, where does that bring you?
The Republican argument saying that this is a unique moment in Irish history. There has never been a Dáil in Irish history. There's never been an authentic Republican body that genuinely was elected by the people and which has stood on the Republic amidst all the trials and tribulations of the 1919 to 21 period. You have the blood of the martyrs of McCurtain, McSweeney, all the rest of Bloody Sunday, Kevin Barry, that you've paid this price, and every single one of those sacrifices have been in the name of the Republic. And you cannot, without betraying the memory of the dead, make this step. So again, and that was a very, very emotive argument. And you have people like Mary McSweeney in the chamber. You have the widow of George O'Callaghan, the murdered Limerick mayor of Limerick.
But someone has to chart a course.
Well, and exactly, and that's the other side of the argument, is that at some point in time, again, you have to. And Collins makes there's a fascinating part of Collins's speech, where in effect he says that you have to have the living nation. Do we never think of what it is to create the living nation? I mean, are we always to constantly obsess with maintaining a fight that ultimately we can't win? Or are we genuinely, as Republicans, determined to realise the potential of the people using the full powers of the people? And that was a powerful argument as well. There were very good arguments put forward on both sides. I mean, as with most debates that go on for a while, there was a certain degree of repetition and diminishing marginal returns. Each new speaker, there's less scope for them to say something new. But the sincerity of all those spoke, I don't think, can be doubted. Even in some cases, you have rather odd contributions where you have some pro-treaty Republicans saying, we're voting yes for this simply because it gives us time to get more weapons in, and then we can start fighting the British again. but we'll be in a better position to do so. So you have people making arguments in favour of the treaty, but still ultimately believing that you will have war with Britain, but that the treaty gives you the breathing space, the temporary breathing space, in order to fight that war on a more substantial basis.
Well, maybe I'm... I almost think, are they covering their arses?
Well,
it's
looking at both sides. I mean, but that's the point.
Maybe I'm a bit cynical in that
regard. Well, but many of the pro-treaty Republicans, we are still Republican. We still believe in the Republic, but we're taking the stepping stone approach. This is, again, one of the metaphors used by Collins.
Yes, yes.
If you can't make the giant leap for Irish kind with one step, then you make it with several steps, and that you do it incrementally, and that you can do that in good conscience. In effect, he argues that coming back to the point is what do we need to create an Irish state? He said we need the British out, and we need, in effect, the economic levers of power in our hands. So things like the banks and so on and so forth. He said, and these economic levers of power, ultimately, he said, have been used by the British over centuries to embed their rule. And he says, once the British are out, both economically and militarily, then you've got enough to be working from. It's not the ultimate goal that he said he wanted. It isn't the Republic. But even a Republic has to start somewhere, as he would say. And this is... We've got everything that we need, and what remains to be got will naturally follow. And again, and you could argue in the course of time, most of that argument has been borne true, with the exception of the border. And of course, you also have the European Union, the creation of which was unimaginable back in the circumstances back in the day. So that's created a whole new dimension. But ultimately, the border is the one thing that remains unresolved. But Collins, I think, genuinely believes that the British want the border to go, because Lloyd George said that it's in the interests of Britain that the border goes. If you're agreeable to stay within the empire, then...
Which they were,
which Collins was. And if you're willing to give us the things such as defence facilities, which we're needing, which the British were, the Irish were, if you're willing to pay your share of the war debt, which Collins says, okay, we'll pay that as well. Then ultimately, I think Collins genuinely believes that either the British would put sufficient pressure on the unionists to get them to vote themselves in, or if they voted themselves out, to remain in, but if they voted themselves out, an authentic border boundary commission would be established. And ultimately, the same thing ultimately would happen, perhaps over a slightly longer period of time, and you would have a very substantial transfer of territory, and the British might realise. And of course, remember that would include transferring a large number of unionists into the south. It would keep a solid unionist bloc in the north, but the unionists in Armagh, the unionists in Fermanagh and Tyrone, the unionists in West Derry would all go into the south. So the unionists would be facing an appalling situation that they would be losing a large number of their own supporters. And those supporters, the hope would put pressure on Craig and others to ultimately make their peace with the rest of the people. And of course, remember that the unionists believed that they were Irish. Believed in Ireland as a distinct entity,
and that Ireland was a fundamental part of Britain.
Yes,
or at least the United Kingdom.
Their allegiance, their British identity would be secured within the empire.
So it's still the quagmire. Then, I mean, what really could the anti-treaty forces engaging in civil war have hoped possibly to achieve, even if they're standing for their, the romantic belief. And, it's not pragmatism versus romanticism,
no, it's
really.
No, it's not. I mean, on the basis that both sides have their pragmatism and romantic. I mean, ultimately, I think the it's a fight that is forced on the Republicans, that they don't start the conflict.
Okay.
They're
so
beaten to the
punch. So it's a defensive measure in the first place.
But ultimately, remember that most of the War of Independence IRA went anti-treaty. So there is a belief that once the war starts, and certainly once the initial urban warfare in Dublin is finished, which takes place about a week, but the Republicans are beaten pretty quickly, that the Republicans will go back, in effect, to the same type of guerrilla tactics which served them so well during the War of Independence. The problem was, of course, now that you were dealing with people who knew the lie of the land, in some cases you had former members of the IRA had gone pro treaty, and they knew the safe houses, they knew the weapons dumps, they knew the sympathisers. And of course, and now you probably had the vast majority of the or at least a significant majority of the population supporting what was being done by the pro treaty forces, where you didn't have that civilian support for what the British had been doing. So the circumstances in which this new guerrilla campaign are being fought are much less advantageous than had been the case even 12 months before against the British.
No, it's a different ball game in that regard. But let me just get the Collins and Dev thing then. I mean, was their relationship a good one prior to? I mean, how did they feel about what happened? And are we right to pin those two as the key linchpins?
Well, ultimately, remember that Griffith is the leader of the delegation to London. Collins is his subordinate. He's a very important subordinate. But Griffith is the figure that is consistently neglected. Although Fine Gael would regard him as being one of the forebears of ultimately the pro-treaty party, Cymru Gwael, which becomes, after evolution, Fine Gael. So Griffith is the other major figure. So you have two big figures on the pro-treaty side. De Valera is clearly head and shoulders above anyone else on the anti-treaty side. That they were all on roughly the same page until the treaty vote, the signing of the treaty. Griffith had made clear that he wasn't going to refuse to sign something if he thought that it satisfied his requirements. And Griffith, remember, had advocated for dual monarchy, the original Sinn Féin, back in 1905, 1906. He had been prepared to accept some form of monarchy originally. In 1917, when Sinn Féin had gone Republican, he'd stepped down. But it wasn't really a huge deal breaker for Griffith in the way that it was for so many others. But Collins, ultimately, in the meeting in Dublin before the treaty is signed, says, OK, I won't sign. And then he does. And this is really what gets De Valera, it makes him angry. That he said, we'd agreed both back at the start of negotiations and just a couple of days ago that you weren't going to sign that, and now you've signed. I mean, remember also De Valera.
Was Collins ever able to answer that?
Well, not really, no, other than to say, well, that's the deal. I mean, we did get some changes between last weekend and this version.
What you said earlier. I didn't quite discern that.
Yep.
So it was kind of like, here's what they're saying. No, that's not right. Few little changes, and Collins is like, that's better.
It's just enough now that there are.
And I'll go with it.
Now, of course, remember that De Valera.
Should Collins have given way to Dev in that and said, unless my superior authorized it? No, because he was a plenipotentiary.
Well, he was a plenipotentiary, and he said, and De Valera accepted that the plenipotentiaries had the right, as it were, legally speaking, to sign. But he ultimately says that it did involve, sort of, it was both unwise and involved ignoring instructions.
Both felt left down by each other?
Well, certainly in terms of how things subsequently developed, the parting of the ways was never subsequently healed, even though they continued to talk to each other, that they signed the electoral pact before
and
the
again,
election.
And again, am I wrong in focusing on Collins here? Should Griffith be more to the fore here?
I mean, what's interesting, of course, is that when De Valera steps down as president of the Dáil after the treaty vote, it's Griffith who replaces him as president of the Dáil, but Collins becomes chairman of the provisional government, and it's the provisional government that the British recognise and deal with, not the Dáil. But there is one important point in terms of the split. De Valera had, you mentioned earlier on about De Valera coming back from America, there had been a huge split in America involving De Valera just 6 months before, where De Valera had found himself on one side of a split and people like Judge Coughlin and John Devoy had been on the other side of the split. So De Valera had bitter experience of the damage that could be done to the cause if a split occurred. So I think De Valera genuinely was obsessed with trying to avoid that type of split, precisely because he realised that if you had sort of a split, the British would be able to widen the breach, which ultimately is what happens. So De Valera, I think genuinely, this idea that De Valera was setting Collins up or anyone up, I think is absolutely wrong. De Valera genuinely believed that unity was possible, but only on the basis of external association, i.e. internal republic, voluntarily associating as a illustration of sovereign power with Britain, but that you had to maintain unity, and when that unity is then fragmented by the signing of the treaty,
it's the fact that the signing copper fastened the division
yeah.
was the straw that for Dev wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, he realizes that once those signatures are on the treaty.
And that's over in London, those signatures.
Now, what he does do is that...
Because it still has to be approved.
It has to be sanctioned by the door.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, and this is what De Valera says, is that he then comes up with his famous document number two. What he says is that we can't vote in favour of this document. Here's another document which incorporates almost verbatim certain sections.
So almost he renegotiated the treaty in a different...
Ultimately saying that...
Well, he didn't negotiate it, he rewrote it.
He wrote it and said that we should agree ourselves on this.
Yes, and go back to them and say, this is pretty much that, but with a few twists.
But Collins and Griffiths saying, listen, we've done this already. We've put these ideas to Britain. They've said no. The treaty is the document they've signed and we've signed. Mm. It's that is the only game in town. And ultimately, we have to make there's no point debating a document that isn't going to fly. This is the only document that we're talking about. Mm. So we talk about this document. And De Valera was subsequently embarrassed by document number two because it did include certain phrases and concessions. For example, with regard to Northern Ireland, where he was agreeable to some form of partition, so long as some sort of essential unity was maintained, that you would have a Dublin
overarching.
Exactly. But you give huge amounts of autonomy too. Yeah. Ultimately keeping the Northern Parliament in being, but just merely
His vision for the Ireland was like Britain's vision for Ireland, independent but within the Empire.
Yeah, exactly.
And his was like a Northern Ireland but within Ireland.
Exactly. there is a certain similarity. Mm. So ultimately, I mean, in terms of De Valera, when he was in his retirement and his biography is being written, his official biography in the 1960s and into the early 70s, De Valera was completely obsessed with that period, ultimately from the truce through to the signing of the treaty and the outbreak of the Civil War. And all his time in power in the 30s, in the 40s and in the 50s, he wasn't really that bothered about putting himself correct on the record, because ultimately he thought that the record stood for himself. He clearly felt himself vulnerable, his reputation vulnerable, because he believed that his motives and his actions had been misrepresented. And then he was determined, in effect, to put his side on the record, as he had done, of course, to a certain extent, with the Dorothy McArdle book, which he mentioned at the very beginning. That account is, in effect, the De Valera version of the entire period. Even though De Valera, doesn't have De Valera's official imprimatur, De Valera writes the introduction to it. And ultimately, it is the Fianna Fáil account of what had happened.
Interesting. So that's a text to look at.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to understand an anti-treaty argument, because, of course, there were others who ultimately broke with De Valera in the mid-1920s over things like entry into the Dáil, ready to swear the oath of allegiance, which De Valera ultimately does in 1926. But it certainly is the Fianna Fáil version and interpretation of the history, at least as it stood in the 1930s. Whether, of course, Fianna Fáil would stand over it now is another matter. But certainly in terms of how Fianna Fáil interpreted that period, that text is absolutely central.
I'm almost loath to start inquiring any further because we've, you know, covered a tranche. I still don't really feel I've gotten, not necessarily to the nub of it, but probably there isn't an answer to it, because there is no other alternative option that would have been amenable to both sides, or that would have changed the situation, really, because if there was, someone would have come up with it then.
I mean, De Valera, both with external association during the treaty negotiations and in the form of document number two, puts forward that view. But I mean,
but with the benefit of history, is there anything we can say now? Well, actually, you know what? If they'd done this, that would have made it better, or maybe he shouldn't have done that and he should have gone with it. Or
I'm loath well, I mean, and you recognise the validity of the motives of the people, that they genuinely are trying to do their best.
The Civil War did not advance anybody's cause, did it? Was anything made in any way better by it?
Well, I mean, ultimately you could argue that Collins believed that... and of course, Collins dies during the Civil War. Mm. He didn't intend to die. He intended to win the Civil War. Mm. But I mean, what it does do is ensure that the British do pull out, and you do have...
The Civil War ensures that they pull out because
it proves
and
the British do complete their military pullout on foot of the...
Okay, so I can see as well the kind of the jeopardy that's there on that. So it's like we... we were forced to take on our former colleagues in order to show that we will rule this country, or
in order to get to the stepping stone, to take to the next stepping stone,
and then you're left in are the British leaving with a little bit of a laugh in that regard? I don't mean a laugh, but they've forced the situation. They've gone, now there you go, you deal with it.
Well, there's a very interesting quote in General Field Marshal Montgomery's autobiography. I mean, he wrote a biography. He'd served in Cork. He was the brigade major based in Collins Barracks.
Yeah.
I mean, it was under his purview that many of the operations carried out in Cork had been conducted. And he clearly despised his time in Cork. He thought it was absolutely destructive of proper military discipline. And as a professional military officer, he was thoroughly delighted to get out of the place because he believed it was breaking the army and that it was undermining the capacity of the British Army to conduct proper military operations. So certainly there were many people who believed that the Britain were better off out, so long as they had got the guarantees and the points that they needed, which they did, so long as they'd had the naval facilities, which ultimately Britain as a naval power was primarily obsessed with. And there was also a very interesting quote in Montgomery's autobiography, where in effect he notes that the pro-treaty side was willing to do things that even the British weren't. The pro-treaty side were willing to carry out larger numbers of executions than even the British had done, and with perhaps less evidence than the British had done. So from that point of view, and I mean, Montgomery was a serious soldier. That his view, I think, was widely shared amongst the professional officer class. Remember that a very significant proportion of the upper echelons of the British Army in the Second World War had served in Ireland during this War of Independence. There was a fascinating quote I saw from one of M.R.D. Foote, who was a member of Special Operations Executive in the Second World War and ultimately became its historian. He said the germ of the idea between Special Operations Executive was taken straight from the IRA. We looked at what the IRA had done to us and what Montgomery and others had learned in their lessons, and we taught it to the French resistance, and we encouraged the resistance movements in Poland and elsewhere. So while the British did get out of Ireland, I think we're glad to do so, that some of the lessons they learnt about how to conduct unconventional warfare were put to use, as it were, in a much bigger theatre of operations in the Second World War.
You mentioned that the Republicans in Dublin were beaten in a week. There's a retreat to rural areas. Cork's a big part of that. There are many theories as to why Cork's referred to as the real capital and all of that sort of thing. But is one of them because it's a Republican capital for 6 months?
Well, it's interesting that the Republicans move to Cork and they've got taken control of Collins Barracks and they control the city. You then have, and this event is I think, very much neglected in the history of Cork, in the few weeks after the fall of Dublin, you have an amphibious landing.
Oh, I've read John's book, John Borgonovo, your colleague in UCC, the invasion of Cork. And it's a fabulous read.
So you have an amphibious, sort of almost clandestine landing of Free State troops.
One of a number at the same time.
Yes,
of amphibious
landings. You had landings in Limerick, you had landings in Tralee.
A and bold elsewhere. Move.
Well, I mean,
unexpected.
In effect, what you do is you land troops and behind, what passed for the line, and you force Republicans, in effect, to retreat further.
So and into you take Monkstown and Passage, is it?
So they land in Passage, and you have approximately a 3-day battle along the line of the Passage through to Rochestown, also over the hill, and the Republicans fight very hard, and you have a number of casualties on both sides. You have machine guns and the like, before ultimately the pro-treaty forces have fought their way ultimately to just where sort of the Rochestown Douglas area, and the Republicans realise that if they don't pull out completely, the Free State might be able to go around the back and cut off their line of retreat. So the Republicans retreat into Cork City and then retreat to West Cork. So the city itself falls. And of course, it's on that basis that the Collins then comes to Cork City only a few days later. And ultimately meets his doom two or three days later.
I remember when I connected those two things in terms of timeline, I kind of wondered to myself, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm viewing it in the wrong light, you know, was there a little bit of hubris in Collins? I think I might even have asked you this in one of our previous chats, and you said no. I mean, he was on his home territory, he was on his home turf. Mm. But, you know, knowing that the city had been abandoned by the IRA, back down into West Cork and into their own sort of the territory that they knew so well, let's say, and had fought in so well. And for him then to go down and go on a tour of West Cork,
I think it was unwise, because precisely because you have all the best Republicans, the hardline Republicans, are now concentrated in one area in a way that they had previously been more spread out. So it certainly was militarily more risky. I mean, obviously, Collins believes that flying the flag and sort of an audacious act such as this, to a certain extent, makes a statement and would serve to undermine the morale of the Republicans, that if you have your number one enemy going driving through your midst, how further away can defeat be?
So there was maybe method to the madness.
I certainly think it was unwise to go down in an open car.
Yeah.
If he'd been in an armored car or in a much bigger convoy.
Although he's in the what you call him is with us.
The Sliabh na mBan car, but Collins isn't in it.
Mm.
But of course, had he been in, he wouldn't have had the demonstration effect being...
So it was a deliberate thing, okay.
Well, I mean, it's impossible to know.
Yeah, it is impossible to know for certain.
But I mean, what he was doing is that he was going down on a tour of inspection because there were areas which were already under Free State control.
Okay.
He obviously takes in a spin to his home area also. So it, to a certain extent, it's flying the flag.
Yeah.
It's a tour of inspection. And it serves, as it were, as a psychological boost to his supporters and a psychological weapon to the heart of his opponents.
Okay, and he's nearly back into the city. He's at Béal na Bláth.
Yes.
I heard a piece of audio recently of from a witness or someone who was in the Free State Army with him on the day, and the audio effectively says that it had all finished. The shooting had stopped, and it was at that point of the inspection that Collins got up, and it was at that point that he was shot. And there's all sorts of conspiracy stories.
Remember that the ambush, which had been in place for many hours, that the Republicans had started to demolish, take the ambush away, because they believed that Collins had managed to get back to the city by another route. So ultimately, when the Collins party arrives, it's the ambush party which is ultimately ambushed. I mean, they're the ones who are taken by surprise. So ultimately, what the ambush is doing is not trying to kill Collins. They're just trying to get away without being killed or captured. And you have this firefight with, as time goes on, fewer and fewer shots being fired as the Republicans disengage and move away. And Collins then makes the fatal mistake of in effect, putting his head above the parapet and standing up to be shot. And,
well, he goes out and walks around.
And there's different accounts, because again, remember, most of those present are quite correctly keeping their head down.
Yes.
In effect, he sees that the Republicans are disengaging. He stands up, and the account that I've heard is that he said, let's get them and go after them. And one of the Republicans who were covering the retreat gets a shot off again to try just as much to suppress the pro-treaty forces, and manages to take out Collins. Whether he knew it was Collins or not, I think it's very, very doubtful.
Mm.
But he just took a shot at the obvious targets because he had this individual standing up. It's a difficult shot. I mean, I'm not somebody who's ever fired a weapon, so I don't really know what I'm talking about. I have taken American students down to the site who many of them had served in the military and so on and so forth and knew how to handle guns. And I explained where the general consensus of the position was of both where the shot was fired from and where Collins fell. And he made the point that, considering the weapons that was being used, but he made the point that those weapons in those days were pretty accurate because they had long barrels. And if you had a sniper who knew what they're doing, it would have been a difficult shot.
But not impossible.
Certainly if you had a stationary target. And Collins seems to have moved toward the target rather than moved laterally. And obviously coming towards the target, ultimately the head stays in the same place. Whereas if he'd moved from side to side or stayed low or not put his head up at all, it would have been less difficult. So, and again, I defer to anyone with military expertise, but it was, you're talking sort of 100 yards or so, maybe a little bit more. In gathering gloom, where all you're trying to do is ultimately suppressing fire as much as anything else, rather than a precision shot. But it is a precision shot, and it does ultimately take out Collins. Now, of course, there are conspiracy theories that he'd been shot by his own side. I'm not sure that even if you'd had an autopsy, anyone could ever say, because whether you had an exit wound or an entry wound, it depends on exactly the point that Colin's head was turned when the shot was done. And if he turned to his own side, then you would have the entry wound at the back of the head and the exit wound at the front. So the position of exit and entry wounds
wouldn't have been conclusive.
It's not like the JFK shooting where you have footage of where he of which direction he was actually looking, then you can figure out which direction it was coming from. So, I mean, even if there had been an autopsy, it's highly unlikely that even if you'd retrieved the bullet, it would have said very much, because pretty much everybody's using the same type of weaponry. So it's impossible to say, but there seems no logic to any thesis that somehow Collins could have been shot by his own side. It just seems that he's taken out in the closing seconds of an engagement where, had he just exercised a degree more discretion, then he would have got out of there alive. But Collins had survived for 2 or 3 years, in effect, almost by defying logic and almost thumbing his nose at discretion. So he dies as he lived. And with who knows what would have happened had he lived. And the fact that Collins had died, Griffith had died only a week before, was a devastating blow to the pro-treaty side. So, and if you're looking at how the
Griffith's civil, death was...
Griffith's death was from a brain hemorrhage. So the final months of the Civil War become... are desperate. This is when the executions begin. This is when people like Cosgrave saying, if we have to execute thousands, we will do so. I mean, as it were, the deaths of thousands of people are worth the life of a nation. And this is where the real bitterness enters the Civil War after Collins' death. That's not to say that, that it wouldn't have happened anyway and it wasn't already bitter, but certainly the executions...
who's in charge then?
Cosgrave. Cosgrave had took over. He becomes the leader of the provisional government. He calls the Dáil in September 1922. It ratifies the Free State Constitution, and then that comes into effect on the 6th of December 1922, a year to the day after the signing of the original treaty. And that's the day that the Free State comes into existence, and that's the day that Cosgrave becomes president of the Executive Council. The term Taoiseach only comes into existence with the 37 Constitution.
So 6th of December, well, don't worry, we're at an end. I'm not going to try to delve further, but I'm just, so it's the 6th of December 21 is the treaty signed in London,
and the 6th of December 22
is the creation of the Free State. In this decade of commemorations, the decade of centenaries, obviously we commemorate it, we remember it, and we discuss it and debate it and toss it around. Is there anything, where is the, you know, where do we celebrate the founding of the state?
Well, it's an interesting point.
It's hard to say.
Well, I mean, given that nobody wanted the Free State, I mean, even the most passionate advocates of the Free State on the pro-treaty side said, this isn't what we fought for. I mean, this is what we're prepared to settle for, and we're looking to improve on it. So at the time, there was very little enthusiasm. Precisely because the Civil War was being fought, executions were taking place. So there was no celebration at the time on the day of the creation of the Free State. Really, the first time that you have any great celebrations, in 1949, when the Republic is declared and Ireland leaves the Commonwealth, you have very substantial celebrations, because ultimately it is regarded this is genuinely delivering on what had been aimed for in 1916 and in the War of Independence. In terms of the present government policy, there's a recognition that, let's say, on the Fine Gael side of the house, clearly they regard themselves as the descendants of the pro-treaty side. Fianna Fáil regard themselves as being at least one of the branches of the descendants of the anti-treaty side. Sinn Féin regard themselves as being descendants of one of the other branches of the anti-treaty side. So there is general sort of, the fact that you have Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in coalition means that there's agreement to mark the Civil War, but as it were, as a tragic event. And to be non-judgmental in marking all the losses on both sides without necessarily saying that one side was right or the other.
Well, I think we've established in our conflict there was no right or wrong, was there?
Exactly. But now, in terms of ultimately the terminal date, you mentioned about the decade of centenaries. I mean, when is the decade going to end? It's very interesting that the government thinking is Ireland's entry into the League of Nations. which happens in 1923. It's not the end of the Civil War.
But it's when we're embraced.
Well, it's ultimately when they argue that the delivery or the deliverance, at least partially, on the vision of when Ireland takes its place amongst the nations of the world, well, then and only then let my epitaph
be written. Just going to say it. That's what I was going to say. Does Emmett's epitaph deserve to be written at that point, or is it still in... Well, is it still on hold?
Well, I think the engraver, his hand is he's just stayed. I think when the border goes, my own personal view is when the border goes rather than if the border goes. Mm. I think at that point, then you genuinely will have all the sort of, you will have broad consensus as that it's taken a long while to get to this point, but ultimately this is where we wanted to go. Whether the unionists agree to that or not is another matter. But at the moment...
Well, I mean, when you look at the different constitutions, and, you know, it's interesting, I kind of forgotten that, like, the provisional government, the Republican Dáil was a different thing.
Yes.
To the, you know,
But the term Dáilearen is still maintained.
Yes.
But clearly it is a different entity, both in terms of its geographical extent.
Because I remember in history there was the first Dáil, there was these terms when you'd learn
You have the first Dáil between 1919 and 21, you have the second Dáil 21 through to 22, which is the Dáil that negotiates or discusses the treaty. You then have the third Dáil, which is called the third Dáil, but which that's the Dáil which ultimately is the Free State, the first Free State Dáil. There's a question as to whether it should be called a Dáil. There's a question of whether in its earliest month it should even be called a parliament, or should it be a constituent assembly, because it's merely discussing the constitution rather than having the power to do anything.
Yes.
So there's a lot of sort of discussion about the technical terms that you use to describe, but clearly there is a very sharp break between the second Dáil, as it's called correctly, and the third Dáil.
But, you know, I suppose where I was going with that was to say, you know, you mentioned about would the unionists agree to it or whatever, but I mean it would seem to me that if there's to be an Ireland that's a one thing, it'll need to be rediscussed and reconstituted.
Yes, of course.
And there will be further change inherent in that.
Yeah. But ironically,
that will cause argument.
But ironically, that the unionists would probably be in a less strong position now than had they made the call 100 years ago, precisely because the Southern Unionist body has disappeared, and the mix in the North would have shifted towards a Catholic majority, whereas 100 years ago, the Protestant Unionist community were in a significant majority. So they're in a less strong, they will presumably be, if and when it happens, in a less strong position to negotiate terms now than they would have been 100 years ago.
Gabriel Doherty, thanks for the conversation again.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a Red FM podcast. For more extra content, go to redextra.ie.